Welcome to another episode of Tell Me Another, a program dedicated to telling great stories from the past. Stories of genius and folly, compassion and cruelty. But instead of sitting around a campfire telling stories of our ancestors, we're coming to you from the History Department of the U.S. Naval Academy, located in Annapolis, Maryland. We're coming with stories to tell, and we hope you will listen. With us in the studio today are three associate professors at the Naval Academy, Thomas Burgess, Hayden Bellinoy, and Matthew Janique. Today, we're going to be talking about carving out empire, partition and the end of empire in India. Associate Professor Hayden Bellinoy is a legal and religious historian of South Asia, and he is going to get us started.
Most listeners are aware of where India is. They know it's an ancient civilization. They are aware of the figure of Gandhi. They're probably aware of Hinduism, with its complex social hierarchies and multiple gods and goddesses. They are also likely aware that India was ruled by the British for over 200 years. But it's probably fair to say that fewer listeners are aware of where the country Pakistan came from, and that India and Pakistan were once part of British-controlled India. Even less familiar would be the fact that Pakistan and India, as modern nation-states, came into being only in 1947. This would be remarkably recent given the longer history of India as a culture and civilization. This discussion aims to introduce our listeners to one of the most traumatic and often overshadowed events of the mid-20th century, the partition of colonial India into two separate nation-states, India and Pakistan, the complex and strained process of negotiation between the British, the Indian National Congress, and the All Indian Muslim League, and the decision to divide territory that the British had spent 200 years unifying, was greatly shaped by events on the ground. In the aftermath of World War II, the single most valuable colony for any European empire in history was thrust front and center into British calculations of how they could adjust to a world order in which the British Empire was on wobbly stilts. For a period of about 2 years before 1947, the story of the British Raj was not whether the British would leave. India would gain independence. The more important question was how they would leave and what shape India would take politically after being ruled for over 200 years. And it's important to remember that these were not light matters. The Indian subcontinent consisted of nearly 420 million people, roughly 17% of the world's total population of 2.5 billion. So by sheer virtue of demographics, this was a significant slice of humanity. After the partition of British India in 1947, the creation of the separate nation states of India and Pakistan led to what is arguably the largest human migration in history. Some estimated 10 to 20 million people were dislocated and made refugees as a result of higher political decisions. A further estimated 500,000 to upwards of possibly 3 million were killed as a result of the partition and accompanying violence. Coupled with the wartime economic dislocations as a result of being a British colony during World War II, and coupled with the horrific Bengal famine of 1943, the sheer number of humans killed, injured, and displaced was no less significant than what was horrifyingly taking place in Europe at roughly the same time.
Hayden, it seems astonishing that a small, dank little island off of Europe should end up controlling one of the world's great civilizations. How do the British control India?
Well, it's a good question. By the 1940s, the quickest way to get to that question is to look at the structure of the colonial nation state that the British had built up really in intensity after the early 1800s. The number of the British in India at any time in terms of civil servants, for example, was never more than 2,000. It created what I would, and some other historians would call a autocratic bureaucratic Raj, basically. It was a highly bureaucratized sort of colonial administration with specialized departments. And it was a civil service that had extreme executive authority to sort of make decisions. Because it wasn't a colony, it was able to do this without consulting Indians one bit. So that on the one hand, there's the civilian administrative side, but on the other hand, it's also the sheer reality of sort of, you know, military force. It's probably fair to say that the British Raj was as much a bureaucratic sort of nation state as it was a stand arming camp, basically. Always historically one of the largest standing armies in the world at any given time. And then actually, by after World War I, the British had managed to actually recruit the largest recruitment volunteer army ever in history, upwards of nearly 2 to 3 million soldiers. So you combine these together, and I think that's probably a good, succinct way to kind of explain how such a small number of people, in particular from a smaller, for a long time, what was a peripheral island off the northwestern coast of Eurasia, was able to kind of rule what they saw as sort of the legacy of the Mughal Empire. That was basically an all-Indian empire. Here it helps to have a look into the personalities of the major players involved in what we would call the last act of the Raj. For their personalities, backgrounds, and combined experiences shaped their political posturing, their reaction to proposals from the British, and their competition among each other for what a future independent Indian state would look like. Let's start with Jawaharlal Nehru. Born into a Kashmiri Brahmin family of Pandits, or religious scholars, who had settled in Allahabad, Nehru was born into a political life. His father, Motilal Nehru, was an early member of the Indian National Congress Party and an early constitutional nationalist, advocating effectively for the Irish equivalent of home rule for India within the British Empire. Notably, Motilal also owned the very first automobile in the important North Indian city of Allahabad. The Nehru family were very much modernists who benefited from the colonial connection. Both Jawaharlal and his father received an English education, with the former going through a very traditional elite trajectory of schooling, Rugby boarding school in England, and then on to Cambridge University. Like so many of his nationalist peers, Jawaharlal was also trained as and became a lawyer. And while he hailed from a very elite Brahmin family, it would be fair to characterize Nehru's outlook as fairly agnostic. He often referred to himself as a scientific humanist, and very much took a modern, almost Protestant type approach towards Hinduism, and supported reforms to what he considered superstitious practices and traditions, such as child marriage and caste discrimination. In a way, it would be fair to characterize Nehru as a very professor-type intellectual. He read widely and wrote scholarly comparisons of Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity. And it's perhaps this very broad, liberal outlook that shaped his view towards religious dogma and religious community. He very much envisioned India becoming a secular, independent nation that would nevertheless account for the diversity of India's religious and spiritual traditions. From one perspective, Nehru was very much a visionary, which is suggested in his 1942 monograph, The Discovery of India. In terms of his demeanor, Nehru often cast a magnetic charm upon women he encountered, and female European photographers found Nehru quite handsome and alluring. Now let's turn to Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Born into an Ismaili Shia Muslim family from Bombay, Jinnah was surrounded by a very religiously and culturally cosmopolitan landscape. At the age of 19, he became the youngest Indian to be called to the bar in England. And a year later, he became one of the youngest English-trained barristers in Bombay, and indeed the only Muslim lawyer in the entire city. Possessing a somewhat aloof and removed personality, Jinnah was also a very cold and calculating political strategist. In his formative years, it became very clear that Jinnah was anything but an austere, devoted, and pious Muslim. He was known for wearing the most finely tailored suits ordered from Savile Row in London. He drank single malt whiskies that were no less than 15 years distilled. He was a perennial chain smoker, which in hindsight, we think, exacerbated his tuberculosis diagnosis in the 1930s. And he once repaid a dear friend's favor by copulating with that very same friend's 16-year-old daughter. And we can already see the irony here. The future leader of a state that would normally be defined by its Muslim religious identity fell well short of the mark of what constituted a pious Muslim. And while he shared with Nehru a modernist outlook and was anything but personally religious, unlike Nehru, he was willing to employ the forces of religious politics and passion in order to achieve political ends. It's also important to state that Jinnah and other Indian Hindu nationalist leaders were cut from the same cloth and shared many same experiences. Jinnah originally joined the Congress Party, but he was also a member of the All India Muslim League. It would be fair to characterize Jinnah as representative of the moderate, old guard leadership of the Indian Congress Party that effectively wanted home rule for India within the British Empire. But it was a party that also very much envisioned a secular, constitutional framework for India, which recognized and gave equity to all of India's religious communities, Muslims included. Vallabhbhai Patel, also known as the Sardar or Chief, was less visionary than Jinnah and Nehru, and yet possessed a real stoic streak. Like his nationalist peers, he was also called to the bar, but did not travel to London and was far removed from elite English-speaking circles. For a long time, Patel vied with Nehru for Congress Party leadership, but it was Nehru's prestige, standing, and relative youth that consistently commanded the core confidence of Congress leadership. Patel lacked the globalized, wider aperture that characterized Nehru's and Jinnah's outlooks. But in an important sense, this was actually Patel's advantage. He was known for being a firm and determined realist. His stubborn self-reliance and forceful personality complemented the more visionary idealism of Gandhi and Nehru. And on the British side, Viceroy Louis Mountbatten was instrumental in the last days of the Raj. He was royalty. He was the great-grandson of Queen Victoria. With a long career in the Royal Navy, during World War II, Mountbatten also became Supreme Allied Commander of the Southeast Asian Theater, responsible for all Allied forces fighting the Japanese. Known for his effusive handsomeness and striking demeanor, Mountbatten probably had one of the most ridiculously posh-sounding accents of any leader in Indian history. And he indulged in his vanity. While traveling around India, it was common knowledge that Mountbatten had a personally detailed group of photographers following him on his travels to take flattering photographs. Mountbatten's demeanor was also shaped by a very paternalistic, elite British sense of quote-unquote duty to India, one in which he would characterize the partition of India as one of the, quote, greatest administrative undertakings in human history. Of course, this very elite upbringing also shaped his strenuous relationship with his wife, Edwina Mountbatten. They never got on. They were practically estranged. And it was an open secret that Edwina engaged in a multitude of extramarital affairs. And in fact, it was an open secret that during Mountbatten's tenure as the terminal viceroy of India, Edwina and Nehru had a less than strictly professional relationship. Edwina's extramarital streak apparently fit well with the very alluring charm that Nehru cast over everyone he encountered.
Hayden, what a fascinating cast of characters you've laid out for us, and a very entangled cast of characters, as you imply towards the end. But there's one figure that everyone hears about that you haven't really spoken of yet, and that's Gandhi. What was his role in all of this? Where was he at this time?
So it's a really good question, because when we normally think of Indian nationalism and the freedom struggle, we always think of Gandhi. And that's partially, I think, the result of the hagiography that has been built up over generations around Gandhi. By 1945, Gandhi is actually not a major player in all these discussions. He was utterly central to the mass mobilizations of anti-colonialism in the 1920s and the 30s with the non-cooperation movement, the civil disobedience campaign, and also 1942 with the Quit India movement. But I think what starts to emerge by 1945 is a sort of disenchantment that Gandhi has in terms of coming to terms with the effectiveness of his own strategies. Because after about two decades of anti-colonial mobilization, it's fair to say that by early 1945, British power is as secure in India as it had ever basically been. And that because of that, his idealism and his strategies weren't achieving the desirable stated outcomes. And I think so part of what happens is that he kind of retires to his ashram, his communal farm. He spends a lot of time tending to goats, talking about the virtues of homespun cloth, talking with famous American photographer journalists like Margaret Bork White, for example. But when it comes to the actual sort of discussions and the movements of change that are going to affect constitutional change and the devolution of power, Gandhi is not really at the table. He has more or less effectively ceded to the larger group of people we've just described right here.
Interesting.
Is it significant at all that these leaders of the Indian nationalist movements are educated in Anglo-Indian cultural milieu? What does that give them that others don't have?
I mean, it's a great and very apt question, actually. It is no coincidence that all of these people we've just outlined are beneficiaries of the colonial connection, mainly through their education and their training. Most of them are lawyers, pretty much. So that gives them an advantage in terms of these negotiations, like it did in the 1920s and 30s, where they were able to basically represent themselves when they were put on trial for sedition, for example. But being part of that sort of like Anglo-educated Indian milieu is also significant for a number of reasons. Another reason, because it gave them a much broader aperture of global politics, world cultures, and global history, I think, that, you know, Patel, Nehru, Jinnah, they were all very well read. And they knew the histories of England. They knew the histories of tyranny. They knew the histories of colonial exploitation, both historical and contemporary, with what, you know, France was doing in Southeast Asia, West Africa, for example, right? What the British were doing in East Africa. They were party to this, and they were aware of what was going on. So I think they gave them a great advantage in terms of having a global aperture and outlook, that they were able to say, this is not, for example, just a question of you oppressing us. This is of a bigger pattern, basically. And therefore, these kind of criticisms can get transformed into more universal positive aspects of, like, these are human rights, for example, right? All oppressed peoples want to be their own masters eventually. See, so in a way, it gets back to a very interesting quote I remember reading from a settlement officer in Agra in the 1830s and 40s when they were in India debating whether they should educate Indians and the Indian elite in their traditional, you know, Hindu and Sanskritic sort of forms of education and for Indian Muslims in the traditional Islamic rational sciences. Well, you know, Macaulay and the Anglicists won the day. They thought it would be good to, you know, have a class of Indians who thought and basically behaved like the British. And the settlement officer actually kind of like almost predicted that this is going to be our high road back to Europe. And so, in fact, it comes back, what, 110-120 years later to actually be true, more or less. So there's a great irony that this coterie of people that the British thought would actually ameliorate India to British colonial rule are the ones who actually sort of initiate the separation process, I think. Let's use 1939 as a starting point for a quick background survey. By August that year, the British had more or less successfully blunted, at least for the short term, two major rounds of anti-colonial mobilization. The first was the non-cooperation movement of the early 1920s, and the second was the civil disobedience campaign of the 1930s, the latter of which involved the famous Salt March, in which Gandhi undertook a nearly 240-mile march to the town of Dandi on the west coast of India. And though the oft-trumpeted moral authority of the British had been seriously undermined, constitutionally the British were able to stave off major challenges to their rule. The 1935 Government of India Act, passed unilaterally by Parliament with no Indian input, drew in moderate Indian nationalists who wanted to pursue a constitutional route to further self-governance. And it allowed Indians to vote, importantly, in provincial elections and form ministries in areas of government that were not deemed essential to British authority, such as education and public works. The Indian National Congress Party actually swept the 1937 elections, and to any casual observer, a strange, if not eerie, stability characterized the British Raj by 1939. But of course, the outbreak of global war changed everything. India was at war with no say of their own, and the manpower, materials, and wealth of India were marshaled on a level unparalleled in the colonial era. The Congress Party offered the British support for the war in return for guaranteed concessions towards further self-government, or Swaraj. On the other hand, the All India Muslim League, led by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, claimed to represent the interests of India's Muslims, the second largest religious minority in India, and he had become increasingly wary of what he perceived to be a Hindu-dominated Congress Party, which would not account for the concerns of the Muslim minority in what was anticipated to be a future independent India. When the British offered no concessions for support of the war effort, in 1942 the Congress Party launched the Quit India movement. It was the single largest uprising against British authority since the Indian Rebellion of 1857. And it was actually in this movement that Gandhi decided that the moral niceties of nonviolence could be disposed of temporarily. He preferred what he called natural Indian anarchy to British ordered anarchy. But the uprising was quelled within 8 months. Meanwhile, and particularly important for future partition of India, the Muslim League did not participate in the Quit India campaign and quietly worked with the British throughout the war. And we will see that afterwards this gave them immense leverage when it came to the constitutional negotiations for transferring power. By the autumn of 1945, Britain had won the war and still ruled India. But that rule was coming under increasing strain very quickly, and the inherent contradictions of colonial rule were quickly bubbling to the surface. The Indian Army had for generations been the final guarantor of British power and authority in India. But Indian soldiers who had been captured by the Japanese and recruited to march on Delhi with Japanese help were tried with the crime of waging war against the Emperor King. Treason. This provoked incredibly intense criticism from across the Indian public. The British were further embarrassed when prominent Indian nationalist leaders, such as Nehru himself, offered free legal defense for the soldiers. In 1946, in February, there was actually an insurrection of Indian naval officers and personnel that started in Bombay and spread to Karachi and Kolkata. Nearly 20,000 sailors on 80 ships protested against deteriorating conditions, rations, and pay, and they gained support from the Indian Communist Party, an ominous sign to the British, no doubt. Thus, the last guarantor of British authority, the Indian Armed Services under British command, could no longer be relied upon. Newly elected British Prime Minister Clement Attlee noted in his weekly intelligence report that, quote, the Indian Army, Navy, and Air Force units were no longer trustworthy, and, for the Army, only day-to-day estimates of steadiness could be made. The situation has thus been deemed the point of no return. Pretty sobering stuff.
Hayden, really fascinating account of the colony of India during World War II. I guess my question is about the Quit India campaign. We always think of Gandhi as ultimately a remarkably successful activist who mobilized millions of people and eventually convinced the British to withdraw. But it would seem, at least initially at least, in 1942 or 43, that this Quit India campaign was a complete disaster. Is that the correct assessment, or would you say that ultimately maybe this Quit India campaign paid some dividends for the nationalist movement, or how would you characterize it?
I think that's a very good question because, you know, like good historians, things we always interpret these things as more complicated than their simplicities might tempt us. I think in terms of its stated objective, semantically and substantially, the Quit India campaign is a failure. It does not, the British do not quit India. It's clearly not going to happen during the war, okay? So in that sense, it is a failure, and it is quashed relatively quickly, certainly compared to the early 1920s and early 1930s campaign. You know, the 1930s campaign really continues until 1936 in a way, you know. This is very short-lived. But on the other hand, the uprising of the Quit India campaign is somewhat effective because what it does is it draws into very diverse types of anti-colonialists. Radical revolutionaries who assassinate British magistrates and district collectors, for example, the Indian Communist Party, for example, all these different groups can kind of mobilize under the umbrella of Gandhi because he's not set the moral bar so high this time. He's not saying, don't strike back. He's saying, it's about time we forget about striking back and actually just do it because we're so frustrated. And I think what you do see by the end of 1942, though, is an emergent consensus among the British civil service in India that particularly a newer generation of civil servants who don't come from the elite sort of, you know, upbringing of Oxford and Cambridge, you know, they come from more what we'd call red brick universities, and they come from a less elite background and pedigree, and they're moderately more sympathetic with Indians, and they come to the conclusion pretty quickly that we cannot keep repeating this decade after decade after decade. And I think the Quit India campaign does draw some of that out. So not a complete, it depends what we mean by success or failure. The semantics are also very substantial.
So over the longer term, you're saying that it did convince the British to withdraw because it wore down their resolve to keep resisting the tide of history.
Thank you for tuning in to
yes,
Tell Me Another.
Yes, I think certainly when it came
we
to
hope
the
you
people
like what
on
you
the
heard
ground,
and want to join
right.
us again.
You know, those
soon.
Who are actually putting down
from
rebellions,
all of us
co-opting
at
local
USNA
elites.
History Productions.
I think this
Thank
has
you.
Very little
and
effect for the decision makers in London.